Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. On our program, a discussion with Blake Bailey, a writer who grew up in Oklahoma City, now teaches creative writing in Virginia, and is the author of three highly regarded literary biographies. These books on Richard Yates, John Cheever, and Charles Jackson have been lauded by critics and awarded prizes. And in his new book, Bailey turns his attention to his own family. That book is The Splendid Things We Planned, A Family Portrait. It's now out in paperback, and our discussion today is one that Rich Fisher had with Blake Bailey back when that book first came out in hardcover in the spring of last year. Blake Bailey will soon appear in Tulsa. He'll be doing a Booksmart Tulsa event tomorrow night at 7 p.m. at Lucky's on the Green at the Guthrie Green in downtown Tulsa. That event is free to the public. I mentioned Bailey's work on the writers Yates, Cheever, and Jackson. Those three American authors had a great deal of talent and in their lives a great deal of trouble, by which I mean personal demons, very addictive alcoholic personalities. And in this new book, the memoir, The Splendid Things We Planned, Bailey talks about how his brother Scott was troubled by many of those same demons. In fact, as a critic for Booklist has noted, quote, "This memoir suggests that Bailey's fascination with compartmentalized and addicted people and his considerable gift for explicating the simultaneous bleakness and beauty of their lives may stem from personal experience. Goofy and affectionate but deeply self-destructive, Bailey's older brother Scott careened from one disaster to the next, bewildering and disappointing everyone around him. Though Scott has functional moments, such moments become footnotes to a larger pattern of wrecked cars, jail time, and intoxicated self-pity. Their father, an upright Oklahoma attorney, tries to wash his hands of his son, but Scott becomes increasingly unhinged and unignorable. As his own life begins to blossom, Bailey remains an ambivalent participant in this sad family saga, torn by his antipathy for his brother, yet aware of all that they share. The result is a haunting portrait of more than one tortured soul, and a heartfelt probing of the limits of brotherly love," end quote. Again, the book is The Splendid Things We Planned. The author is Blake Bailey. It's just out in paperback, and he will appear tomorrow night, Thursday night, the 30th at 7 p.m. at Lucky's on the Green. In downtown Tulsa, it's a free-to-the-public Booksmart Tulsa event.
Blake Bailey, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be here.
Now, I have to admit, you join us by phone, and you're speaking from your old high school, O.C. McGinnis, and you're actually in the vice principal's office. I don't know if you were ever there as a student, but I think this is fertile ground for a biographer because, you know, going back to an old high school, it's like this weird vibe you get because it's like it's familiar and utterly unfamiliar, and I was just wondering if you're experiencing that right now.
I am experiencing it in spades. Bishop McGinnis in no way is recognizable as the place where I went to school. You asked if I had spent time in the vice principal's office. As I write in my memoir, I was almost expelled. I was a real behavior problem. And I'm sitting in the vice principal's office now, and it's not evoking those fond memories because it, of course, is the whole building has been transformed. But I remember in those days it was Brother Duane. And he was a very formidable character. He and I had a strained relationship.
Well, it's really interesting, that story you recount. It was like, really? They're going to expel him for that?
It was a constellation of misbehaviors rather than one enormous transgression. But again, yeah, I talk about that in the book.
What made you decide to write about your own family?
Well, I started this book about 11 years ago. I had just finished my first big biography about the writer Richard Yates, and I didn't know what I was going to do next. And in the meantime, my brother Scott, who had led a very difficult life, was coming sort of to the end, and I knew that he was coming to the end, and I knew I'd never see him again. And I was—I had very complicated feelings about that, and was already sort of grieving Scott in advance, and I thought I needed to sort things out in my head, so I started writing our story.
And it took 11 years?
Yeah, it took 11 years. One reason for that is simply that, you know, a couple of very hefty literary biographies about
came
John
in the meantime.
Cheever and Charles Jackson came in the meantime, and that, of course, is very time-consuming, but whenever I was between books, I would return to this, and it was just very, very difficult to write because, you know, when I write a biography, I'm completely objective. You know, I'm just gathering the evidence, and I sort of let the chips fall where they will. You can't do that when you're writing about people you love, because, you know, you have very decided prejudices where they're concerned, and you have to somehow find a way of transcending those prejudices and presenting them as objectively as possible. And so the main thing was, in the course of the 11 years I spent writing this, I rediscovered sides of Scott that I had sort of forgotten because they'd been overshadowed by the chaos of his later life. And that was good, because he was a very sweet, promising, handsome, intelligent, charismatic young man, and it makes it all the more heartbreaking what happened to him later.
I was struck by the fact that, you know, you read a lot of stories where the high school athlete has his greatest moment in life at, say, 17.
Right.
And then there's a slow decline. It seems to me, pardon me for saying this about Scott, it was like his shining moment was about 8 or 9 years old.
Yeah.
And you're laughing, but I mean, the way you write it, it was like he was this wonderful young man, but he was definitely troubled by some serious demons.
He was, and I would say he peaked at about, you know, 12 or 13,
yeah.
But it wasn't a long decline. It was more of a kind of a very precarious roller coaster ride for his adulthood, because... And this is something that I had to sort of discover in the process, the long process of writing the book, was that, yes, Scott was extremely self-destructive, more so than anyone I've never, ever, ever known or heard about, for that matter. But it's not enough to say that he was self-destructive, because Scott always had big plans for himself. You know, he always thought he'd turn it around. He was very idealistic. He was deeply religious. And right up to the terrible, tragic, sordid end of his life, but he still had big plans. So, you know, who knows? Scott is, like every human being, he's an unsolvable mystery, but I understand him better as a result of writing the book.
Now, I was really struck by your biography of Charles Jackson came out the previous year, and of course, Charles Jackson is the writer of The Lost Weekend and sort of experienced a lot of that in his own life. The self-destructive arc is somewhat similar, at least in just the superficial way. Was that an influence at all in deciding to finish this book?
Well, indeed, Rich. All three of my previous biographical subjects, John Cheever, Richard Yates, and Charles Jackson, were all ruinous alcoholics. And I have been repeatedly and understandably asked, have you been all this time just writing about yourself? Because an interesting aspect of my memoir is it's not all about Scott. I have drunk more than I should, and I was very similar to Scott. And it is one of the mysteries that I was trying to solve, was why my life went in one direction ultimately and his in the other. As far as being attracted to colossal alcoholics for my biographical subjects, you know, I was going to take the high road when people asked me that question and say, well, you know, I wrote about those three writers because I admire their work. Well, the fact that their work tends to be about outwardly prosperous middle-class families who were actually blighted by alcohol and mental illness might have had something to do with why I responded so much to their work.
And this is the story you tell in The Splendid Things We Planned, a family portrait. Your family outwardly was very prosperous, very successful. There is a picture on the inside cover that is, I mean, it's got St. Bernard. It's got the family portrait. It's just lacking Norman Rockwell in many ways, although
Absolutely.
It is, you know, in the 70s, it looks like. Yet what was happening was a very, very different story. Take us back to your father and mother. Your father and mother, your father was a very prosperous attorney. Your mother was a German immigrant. I think it's been described many times as a party girl, but she, I don't buy that really. I think she was somebody who was kind of, it seems like, fairly bored in the roles she was expected to attain. She found bohemian friends. She wanted to go back to school, but the family life was really not for her.
Right. I mean, at one point in the book, my mother says, families are the devil's work. And you know, I'm inclined to agree with that. Certainly, it's true of our family. My father was the golden boy of this tiny town in northeast Oklahoma, Vinita. And he got this extremely prestigious law scholarship to NYU. To this day, the Ruth Tilden Law Scholarship is the most famous scholarship in the country. 20 people around the country get it. So he met my mother, who was fresh off the boat, very good-looking, very smart, in Greenwich Village. And they connected because they were both very bright. But then she got pregnant, and that was Scott. And you know, the fun began from there. The thing about our family is, yes, you have four very bright and promising people, I think. And it wasn't that we didn't love each other. We did, decidedly. But we all wanted very different things in life, and we were all sort of pulling in different directions, and that was not good. It was not good for Scott and me growing up, and of course the marriage was doomed always. And to have Scott, someone like Scott, in the midst of that was a chaos that I can scarcely describe, though I think that I pull it off in the book.
The family stories are that Scott was a crier from a very early baby. In fact, there's a story that you said your mother recounted to you, and then she later recanted it, that they had gone up.
There were actually several stories like that, and we really had to negotiate what was allowable for the book. My mother had a lot of problems with this book, understandably, but she was at my reading last night, and she is very brave and very loyal. And, you know, her main request was that I get it right, you know, that I be essentially accurate and that I wasn't excessively critical of herself. But the book opens with Burke and Marlise. They're living in this dorm, Hayden Hall, at NYU on Washington Square, and they're on the roof. And the story I always heard was Scott would not stop screaming and screaming and screaming, and they finally brought him up to the roof and discussed whether to throw him or themselves off. Ultimately, they didn't do that. But and then I tell the other story, which I think I'll spare your listeners for my mother's sake. But of course, that makes no sense because, you know, I've already put it in a book.
Well, I would think with your mother, I mean, there's obviously love there, but there's also a situation where once you move to Oklahoma City, they moved to Kansas City and then Oklahoma City, basically, and Burke practiced law there. She seems very bored. She's looking for something to occupy her time. And at some point, and maybe it's because of the volatility of the family relationship, she just checks out. She takes off. She moves to Norman for the most part.
But she didn't do that in a vacuum, and my father abetted that. I mean, he wanted her to be happy, and it was an open marriage. I mean, anyone who has read or seen the movie The Ice Storm has an idea of what those upper-middle-class open marriages were like. And so Mom had a boyfriend, and she was taking graduate classes in Norman, and my father said, why don't I just get you a condo there? And, of course, Scott was making all of us miserable. And, yes, my mother took off and left us with Scott. And then finally, but it was my mother, you know, who went to New York. And when Scott dropped out of NYU after 2 months and had to deal with the chaos of that situation, Scott had been thrown out of his dorm and wanted to get back in and get his stuff. And, of course, he was stoned out of his gourd all the time. And my mother told him, I'll go in. And there was this big, burly security guy in the lobby who had been specifically retained to keep Scott out of the building. And my mother was going to go up, and Scott started to force his way past the security guard. And security guard threw him out, and Scott scampered around the side of the building and ran, smashed through this plate glass door. And he was arrested, and so on and so forth. And finally, my mother had to tell the judge, we're sending him to Germany. if you don't put him in jail, we're gonna put an ocean between New York and Scott. So they let him off.
Now it's really interesting. You write at a fairly young age. There's this interesting incident, which is you were sort of naturally drawn to your father, and Scott was naturally drawn to his mother, to your mother. And in fact, they took a trip to Germany. And this was a source of envy for you, that he got to go back to Germany with his mother. And it was really kind of interesting because the parallel stories are kind of there. Or do you see the parallels?
Well, yeah. I mean, my father, as a young father, was working so hard, and he was so ambitious. And as long as he could sort of get his work done and go his own way and have a reasonable degree of peace and quiet in his house, that's what he wanted. And I think quite healthily, I was attracted to my father's way of life more than my mother. I mean, my mother was having parties every day. She was, you know, smooching strange men. I observed a lot of this. And there was a lot of drinking and so on. Because, as you point out, you know, this life was not for her. She didn't want to be a Hausfrau. She was profoundly romantic, you know, wanted too many things, wanted everything, basically, but wanted, above all, to have a good time. Finally, when she got bored with that, you know, she became a dedicated student and graduated magna cum laude with an anthropology degree. And to this day lives, you know, a fairly reclusive and productive life. So, you know, that was just where she was at that moment in time. But it didn't make her an especially good mother to Scott and me.
My guest today is Blake Bailey. He is the biographer of Richard Yates, John Cheever, and Charles Jackson. His latest book is a memoir, a portrait of his family, titled The Splendid Things We Planned, a family portrait. It's published by Norton. It's a very, very honest account. And that, I think that's the thing that gets to me, is this, it's almost, you know, how hard is it to get to the honesty, as you always have these rationales and colorings for everything that happens in your life. And it seems like you've spent a lot of times trying to strip as much of that away as you could.
Yeah, it was, again, Scott's later life was so chaotic and so stressful to everybody that it had sort of overshadowed my memories of the earlier, more promising, beloved, and charming young man that he had been. So I had to kind of, I had to force myself to bear that in mind and to remember that. And I also, you know, it wasn't all about Scott making it stressful for us. It wasn't all about Scott failing us. We failed him, too. And I particularly, I mean, I don't blame myself, but I also do. In other words, consciously, I don't blame myself from trying to distance, you know, my life from his. But on another level, you're constantly visited by this grief out of nowhere. You know, I felt nothing but relief when Scott died. I thought it was the best thing that ever happened to him, and certainly the best thing for us. But it didn't keep me from just sometimes out of nowhere being just annihilated with feelings of grief.
And your parents did try to find help for him all along the way, it sounds like. I mean, it sounds like.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was like you had psychiatrists saying, basically, you know, basically throwing up their hands.
The psychiatrist told my father, because my father desperately wanted to help Scott and persevered long beyond what was realistic. The psychiatrist said, and this was when Scott was 23 or so, said, you know, when a child falls, when he's little, you can catch him. And then he gets a little older and he falls from a higher place, and maybe you can still catch him. But later, he's a grown-up and he falls from the top of a building. And then you have to decide, you know, either stand there and get crushed or get out of the way.
Mm, wow. At what point in your life and in your family's life did you realize Scott's situation was outside of the norms? You know, I mean, he was charismatic. You know, you had a real strong sibling rivalry, which seems fairly early became somewhat unhealthy. And I don't know if it was looking for parents' attention or what. It became very resentful early. But what point in your life did you realize that Scott's situation
was...
Well,
now, a lot of this was retrospective.
Yes.
And again, that was part of the process of discovery that was inherent in writing the book. It didn't necessarily seem odd at the time, but in retrospect, it seems odd. Scott was pathologically fastidious as a small kid when he was 11 or 12. He hated people to come into his room. He hated people to move things. Everything was arranged with a kind of cryptic symmetry. He slept on the floor rather than his bed, which was just so, and it had beads around it, kind of like Greg Brady's, you know, attic hideaway in the Brady Bunch. So all that was very weird. And it's silly to say, well, you know, the drugs, that's why my mother's, her refrain throughout life is, if only Scott could stop drinking and taking drugs, he'd be fine. Well, no, of course not. I've now written about three alcoholics, and all of them had pathologies underlying the alcoholism.
Those are symptoms.
In Scott's case, you know, I mean, my wife is a psychologist, and she's almost as skeptical as I am about finding some neat psychiatric classification in the DSM-4 and saying, oh, that's what he is. Scott was a cocktail of pathologies, and I don't think that you could pigeonhole him, but there was something fundamentally wrong with him. But again, these people, Scott could always con cops. He could con judges. You know, he could put up an act. Like any addict, he was a consummate con artist.
I was really, I was really struck by something you wrote about how through his adulthood, he was so rebellious of any sort of authority or position, but people he perceived to be in a lesser socioeconomic level, he was incredibly kind to.
Yes, Scott could be so charming, and not just charming in the con artist way. He had a very sweet and loving heart in many ways. And yes, the downtrodden of the earth, you know, poor people on the street or old ladies or things like that, Scott was just extravagantly solicitous toward. But he was always surly toward, like, waiters. And once, you know, my father had just remarried my stepmother, okay? And so she wasn't really used to Scott yet, and she wanted to gain his trust. So for his 21st birthday, they were going to buy him a car. And so they went to all these car dealers, and always Scott would just get incredibly rude and profane toward the person who was trying to sell him the car, because Scott was very conscious of being condescended to. Go figure. I was never in a particular kind of public situation, in a restaurant, buying clothes, what have you, when Scott did not demonstrate that weird hostility toward people. It was extremely uncomfortable.
I've been really struck by some of the reviewers' comments about the book. They refer to the dark comedy, the black comedy of this. And, I mean, there are some funny incidents, but this strikes me more as a tragedy and a story of survival, basically.
Well, yeah, I liked what Itzkoff wrote in the New York Times book review. You know, he said that it was achingly honest, and he said it's not for everybody. But he says only a few readers are entitled, entitled, like it's a privilege to enjoy this, often frightening but enthralling book. You know, the way I gained detachment on Scott, the whole key to telling the story was assuming an essentially slightly remote, wry tone. For example, when my mother got the news that Scott had killed himself, in jail, no less, she answered the phone. It was the middle of the night. It was the jail chaplain calling. This is a total spoiler, but what the hell, I'll go ahead. And she had stomach cramps. You know, and she had to go to the toilet. And so she was, like, stumbling to the toilet, holding the cordless in her hand, and it just exploded on the toilet. And the chaplain sort of heard what was going on, and so there was this fraught pause. And then the chaplain said, Mrs. Bailey, let's now get down on our knees and pray for your son. You pray for your dead son. And, of course, my mother couldn't get down on her knees under the circumstances, so she said, okay, let's go ahead. You know, she always laughs when she tells that story, and that's how I tell it, you know, is as this sort of funny, but I do better in the book. But that, because, you know, I'll tell you what, one of Hemingway's old writing adages stood me in good stead when I was writing this. Hemingway said, don't describe something. Don't describe the way you're supposed to feel in the given situation. Describe the way you really felt. So I could not say, you know, sort of cadging for sympathy, that I was anything but relieved when I found out about Scott's death. It was later when it suddenly, you know, fell on me like a safe, you know, from a 16-story window. And that's how it goes. Grief is unpredictable and inexplicable. And I think that I tell it like it is, not the way it's supposed to be. And some of that's is funny.
Yeah.
And Scott was, I think Scott would howl reading this book in his the other dimension to where he has now repaired. Because he had his sense of humor and mine was virtually identical.
Yeah. Well, there's you use a great epigram for the book, and it's a quote from Joe Gould's Secret by Joseph Mitchell. I thought it was really, really telling. You obviously spent some time thinking about that. Can you recite that?
Yeah, please do. That's one of the damnedest things I ever found out about human emotions and how treacherous they can be. The fact that you can hate a place with all your heart and soul and still be homesick for it, not to speak of the fact that you can hate a person with all your heart and soul and still long for that person.
Hmm. And that's really Scott's place. I mean, he was capable of great cruelty. You recount one time where he literally beat you to a pulp. And as you're getting away, he starts crying and says, "Don't leave me here." Which,
right.
You know, I mean, it's just, he was,
no matter how just extravagantly, squalid his behavior, no matter how many times he broke our hearts, he always expected nothing but love and acceptance. You know, because that was our role. We were his family. People ask me, you know, why'd you write this story? Why, you certainly don't come off well, and I don't. And, you know, it's airing dirty laundry. Why do you do that? Well, this is why I do it. One, it's my business what I write, and I needed to write this book. But also, everybody has someone like Scott in their life. It may not be a family person. It may be a friend. It's someone that they love and care about and who needs their help. And you try to help them, but it doesn't always work out. And you feel guilt and grieving about that, but you have to get on. You know, there's on the last page of Norman MacLean's A River Runs Through It, the father of Norman MacLean's brother, who dies terribly, rather like Scott, says that it's the people who you live with and love that most try to help that eventually elude you.
Mm. Yeah, that's very strong. My guest today is Blake Bailey. His new memoir is The Splendid Things We Planned, The Family Portrait. One last question that has to do with the idea of, you know, you had to write this story. Has it helped?
Yes, it has helped. It has helped. It was interesting because last night, I won't tell his name, but an old acquaintance of ours came to the reading in Oklahoma City, and he told me, he said, "You know my son," and his son was in my class here at McGinnis, and I knew that he was troubled much the same way that Scott was, and so he brought me up to date on what had happened to his son. It's not good. And he said, "Do you feel better about writing about Scott?" Because he had known Scott. And I said, "Yeah, because now I can talk about it." You know, because I could never talk about it before. My friends, my dearest friends, and some of my best friends still live here in Oklahoma City, and we're very close. And I could never talk about Scott. It was just too humiliating and heartbreaking. Well, now it's out there. Everybody knows. And I guess, actually, it's not so much that I can now talk about Scott. It's that I don't have to talk about Scott. You know, they can read the book. So, yeah, I'm very glad I wrote it.
Blake Bailey, I really appreciate your time. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Writer Blake Bailey in conversation with Rich Fisher last year here on Studio Tulsa. The book is The Splendid Things We Planned, A Family Portrait. Bailey will appear tomorrow night, Thursday night at 7 p.m. at Lucky's on the Green. For more information, booksmarttulsa.com. I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening to Studio Tulsa.